Cet épisode est rendu possible grâce au soutien de Squarespace. Squarespace est la plateforme tout en un pour permettre aux entrepreneurs de se démarquer et réussir en ligne, et ce, quelle que soit la taille de leur activité. Pourquoi est-ce que j'ai choisi Squarespace comme sponsor du podcast? D'abord parce que je sais qu'ici vous êtes très nombreux à entreprendre, avoir un podcast ou un projet qui nécessite d'être valorisé sur un site web. Et que Squarespace propose des outils vraiment simples d'utilisation pour avoir un site beau, propre et efficace en un minimum de temps. Quelques exemples de fonctionnalités, des templates de sites web personnalisables et adaptatifs pour créer des sites beaux et design en un temps record. L'outil email, le nerf de la guerre pour développer votre activité et communiquer avec vos clients. Ou encore leur outil SEO intégré pour émerger sur Google sans être un produit métier. Alors si vous voulez donner à votre business toutes les chances de se développer, je ne peux que vous recommander d'aller sur le site squarespace.com. En plus, Squarespace vous offre moins 10% sur votre première commande de site web ou de domaine avec le code Pauline. N'hésitez pas et rendez-vous sur squarespace.com, code Pauline. Hello, hello mes chers amis, j'espère que vous allez bien, ici Pauline Léniaud et bienvenue dans un nouvel épisode. Pour ceux qui ne connaîtraient pas encore, avec ce podcast, j'essaye tout simplement de décrypter les clés du succès de mes invités, ce qui a fait leur réussite, ce qui a fait leur cheminement personnel, leur philosophie de vie. On discute pendant une heure environ, vraiment de ça, de leur propre réflexion. Et toute mon idée, c'est de vous aider et de m'aider moi-même au passage à devenir la meilleure version de nous-mêmes. C'est le cas aujourd'hui avec un épisode en anglais que j'ai enregistré il y a déjà quelques temps. J'accueille une légende dans le monde de la stratégie. Son nom, c'est Roger Martin. Vous connaissez peut-être d'ailleurs parce qu'il est aussi auteur best-seller et son livre Playing to Win est vraiment l'un des ouvrages préférés qu'on distribue dans les écoles de commerce américaines. Il publie d'ailleurs dans la Harvard Business Review régulièrement. Roger, ce qu'il faut savoir, c'est qu'il a exercé pendant des décennies d'abord auprès d'entreprises connues comme par exemple Procter & Gamble, et il est également un doyen dont on a parlé d'une très famous university au Canada qui est la Rotman School of Management de l'université de Toronto. Dans cet épisode, on a commencé par parler de son nouveau livre, A New Way of Thinking, que je trouvais très intéressant, parce que Roger y compare 14 modèles dominants, et en proposant à chaque fois une alternative, des modèles de pensée, si vous voulez, en se disant, ok, mais est-ce que finalement ces modèles ont raison d'être dominants? Est-ce qu'ils ne sont pas en réalité défaillants? Et quelle est l'alternative possible? C'est ce qu'il fait dans ce livre, ce que je trouve passionnant. Et donc, on a creusé quels étaient ces différents modèles, et en l'occurrence, ça nous a permis de nous interroger sur, par exemple, comment prendre de meilleures décisions, ou comment créer une meilleure organisation au travail et éviter la typique réunionnite dont on souffre tous. Qu'est-ce qu'une stratégie efficace? C'est quoi d'abord une stratégie? Comment repenser le modèle du management? Bref, plein de sujets qui, je suis sûre, vous intéresseront. Et vous verrez durant l'épisode, ce que je trouve intéressant, c'est que Roger nous a donné à la fois des conseils, on va dire, un peu théoriques, de chercheurs, mais aussi ses conseils pratico-pratiques, parce que c'est avant tout un opérateur lui-même pour appliquer ses concepts à nos vies quotidiennes. J'ai beaucoup apprécié cette conversation, j'ai apprécié la personnalité de Roger, surtout à la fin de l'épisode, vraiment écouter la fin, parce qu'il s'est confié beaucoup plus sur sa vie personnelle, et j'ai trouvé que c'était un passage assez fort, pour être honnête, je crois qu'il l'a peu fait par le passé. On est parti un peu dans tous les sens, vous allez voir, mais pour ma part, j'ai passé un excellent moment, j'espère que ça sera le cas pour vous. N'hésitez pas à me le dire sur les réseaux, et à le dire évidemment à Roger, qui est aussi présent sur LinkedIn et sur Instagram. Voilà, longue intro, je ne vous en dis pas plus et laisse place à ma conversation avec Roger Martin. Roger, thank you so much for taking the time. It's an honor. I'm very excited about this interview, very excited to help French people know more your work. So thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me, Pauline. This is a great opportunity for me. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, I'd love to jump in directly in your last book, A New Way to Think. So first of all, I mean, the title is genius. Congratulations. It really gives, you know, I think a full insight on what you're trying to do with the book, but also it really entices people to read it, of course. It triggers a lot of questions for me, and one of which is I feel that a lot of people listening to our podcast would think these types of ideas are great for large organizations. What about smaller companies? And so I'm sure you've put a lot of thought on this, but could you walk us through and tell us basically if you believe that these types of change in terms of mindset or in organization are also relevant for, let's say, like
I don't know, 50-100 people company?
Oh, yes, I do, and I guess that's not surprising that I would think that. Although, what people often don't realize my background, I grew up at the feet of an entrepreneur. It was kind of a fun experience because my dad started our company when I was 2 years old. So I have no recollection whatsoever of anything other than that. And plus I was at the inception of it. And so, you know, I saw all the difficulties and the warts. It almost went out of business a couple times. So it was fun to see. So I do believe that it applies everywhere. And I think that with smaller companies, you have, you know, some things that are bigger problems, and you have some things that are easier. In a smaller company, you have fewer layers, but in a smaller company, it's you know, kind of hard to invest in things for the long run. Sometimes people will say, "Oh my God, there's just no way that I could invest that much, right, in creating a distribution system or whatever." I think small companies have to think about the customer too, right? Mm-hmm. You can have a small customer where you think more about, you know, what's easy for us, right, and impose that on the customer. Or you could be a small company that says what's best for the customer, and we'll think first and foremost about the customer. I do think sometimes small companies don't fall prey to some of the ways of treating people. Like I think sometimes big companies going to treat people as though they're like not human, right?
They say, like a number, basically.
Yeah, they're sort of a number. And things like, you know, what really makes people happy. And I think what makes people happy is not you saying to them, if you do this, take the specific action, I will pay you more money.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that that's how people actually really work. I think people want to be part of an organization they're proud of, and they want to do a good job. They do want to be patted on the back for doing a good job, for sure. But if the pat on the back is, I will give you an extra check for X number of francs or euros, I'm not sure that that works as well as a pat on the back. And you know, next year, a bigger, more important job,
yeah, right? Yeah, so, for sure, perspective.
Yeah, so I think that's like small companies should make sure of two things. I would say one is use their humanity advantage over big companies. Big companies have to spend a lot of time like creating a structure that will help it not sort of blow to pieces because it's so big. And what that does is, I think, stress the sense of humanity, right? People are more comfortable in small groups of people that they know, right? Famously, less than 150 people, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask, the threshold, yeah, according to you, is around 150 people.
Yes. Well, no, that's not according to me. That's according to, now I'm forgetting his name. There's a guy. There's a researcher work to say that after 150, it sort of breaks down, sort of the bonds, and that's why some entrepreneurs, there's a giant one of the biggest auto parts companies in the world. It happens to be Canadian. It's called Magna International. And the guy who founded it would split his split plant. He would have each plant run itself and not want to get a bigger debt than 150 people, so that there was this sort of group. And the company Haier, the big Chinese white goods manufacturer, like refrigerators and stoves and all of that, it's the world's biggest. The head of it, Zhang Rumin, believes in breaking it down into all sorts of micro enterprises, 40,000 micro enterprises, in order to sort of, each of which has the power to hire, fire, and compensate within them.
So a lot of decentralization.
Exactly. So I think, like, that would be my advice to any small business. I'm always into make sure you take advantage of your inherent advantages, right? You will have inherent disadvantages. A giant company will have inherent disadvantages. A small company will have inherent disadvantages. They'll have inherent advantages too. Make sure you don't throw those away. And so if you're a little company and you say, well, we're going to have strict compensation policies and you know, we're going to have a rubric where we have everybody fill out things, and then it takes it's throwing away the advantage it has of being small, right, in order to try and act like a big company. No, say that's what a big company has to do. They have to do all these administrative things. We don't have to do them. Let's not act like a big company. And like at Haier said, hey, it was $50 billion company now, says we're going to relentlessly try to fake like we're a small company, right? even as we're large. That I like.
That's extremely interesting, to be honest, because I don't know if you know this, Roger, but I'm also an entrepreneur. I have a company with about 75 people, so I'm still under the threshold. Yeah, but I feel that we have a lot of time being, I think, complexed. And I think because we're not enough organized or structured and therefore have wanted to, you know, copy-paste in a way intelligent models that we've seen elsewhere, and that, as you are exactly saying right now, are actually not at all aligned with what we are. And so it's a way of shoving away our own advantages. And so it feels good when you say it, and I hope that a lot of people listening to our podcast will feel the same way.
just be really critical. Right. When you see something on the outside, or one of your employees, you know, comes to you and says, hey, boss, you know, this other company did this. Maybe we should do about it. I think one, be open. Any employee gives you a suggestion, you always want to be open, but be critical and just say that works for them. You know, in what ways would it really look like it works for us? And in what ways might it not? Because you might be able to take it and modify it. Right, you don't have to take whatever it is. You know, if they've come, some friend of theirs works at you know, some gigantic CAC 40 kind of company, and shows you, here's the form they use.
Yeah,
be critical and say, well, how could we modify that for use in a small company? The other piece of advice I'd give is be careful of thinking more people is the answer to a lot of problems.
Huh. I'd love to learn more about that. And could you elaborate?
I often think that's the reaction. It's, oh, we're busy. And we'd be less busy if we had more people. You know, this kind of makes sense. This is a new way to think kind of stuff. It's sort of like, that sort of model makes sense. But often people then who hire more people find themselves busier still. Why are they busy? Why are they busy?
I feel it.
Right? See? And it's because what? You're training them up. Getting them kind of to feel the appropriate culture and whatever of, and understand the strategy, and then they're going to be imperfect at that as reflections of what you want, and so you're going to be spending lots of your time doing what? Fixing their work, right?
Yeah.
So you know, I learned this way back when. So some in my previous life, I was one of the leaders of a firm called Monitor Company. It was a strategy consulting firm that started from nothing and became, you know, worldwide fine with 1,000 or more employees. And we hired undergrads and MBAs in the usual cycle. And so that we would recruit them in January, February, March, April to show up September 1. And so we'd have this influx of people showing up September 1. And until that point, we'd be getting busier and busier with the people we have now. And we'd be thinking, we'll get this influx of capacity and everything will be debottlenecked and we will be so happy. And we'd find ourselves way, way busier. And it's because when they came on, the existing people spent enormous amounts of time kind of training them, supervising them, whatever. And so our capacity went down. And so I sort of administratively ran the firm for a number of years. And so I got used to sort of thinking, no. Come September 1, capacity will go down. Our capacity to actually do business, serve our customers, will go down, not up. And I took that after I did that for many years. I went and to become the dean of the Rotman School of Management at University of Toronto. My task was to turn it around from a kind of a crummy business school to a better one. I had this philosophy that I implied there, which is, more people is not the answer. And I said, you get more people and all you get is more meetings. Right. And so we ended up having the best media profile of any Canadian business school. There were 33 business schools. There was a service that measured your share of voice. We got up to 60% share of voice. So the other 32 got 40 share points and we had 60 share points. So people would often come to us from other business schools in Canada or the United States who heard about us and say, well, you know, how have you gotten this high media profile? What do you use, Edelman or one of the big, you know, global kind of PR firms? And we say, no.
We don't recruit.
Yes, and how do you structure your media relations department then? If you're doing it all internally, you do it all internally. You don't outsource this. No, you do it all internally. I said, well, that's a super easy question. We have one guy, Ken McGuffin, and they're like, oh, come on, that's a lie. You're lying to me. You're hiding something. I said, no, one guy. And he wears shorts and he bikes to work. He looks like he's 12. he's awesome, but he did. He's probably 45 now, and he still looks 20. I sat him down and said, "Here's the deal, Ken. I'll support you entirely. If they need me to go on TV or be interviewed, I'll do it. And I will ask the professors to please do that too. But here's what you can do. What you can do is go in and really get to know the professors better, to really know their research, because they do like talking about their work and their research, but they don't want to make it hard. And so they don't want to be asked to do something they're not really expert on. So you got to find their expertise. And then you've got to make sure that you're the easiest call for anybody in the media to make, TV, magazine, newspaper, whatever. The easiest call. If I call Ken, he will line up a professor. The professor won't ghost me. The professor really will do it. You got to be the easiest call. And that's it. One person. And what did he spend his time on? Meeting? No. Although he met with professors to make it, he met with media people. He didn't meet with Rotman kind of other staffers. And we did the same with the magazine. We had a magazine called Rotman Magazine that we transformed it from something that was nothing to a magazine that HBR actually carries the stories of, right, on their site. You can buy Rotman magazine. Yeah. And it became rivaling California Management Review and Sloan Management Review. And so at one point, Harvard Business Review, you know, kind of the leading magazine in the space by far, did a restructuring that resulted in them going down from it was like 11 senior editors to 9 senior editors. One of the senior editors who was laid off phones me up, and I knew him from HBR because I do a whole lot of stuff with HBR. He knew me and said, listen, I've always believed Rot Magazine is my second favorite magazine. To HBR, it's fantastic. And I would love to come work as an editor at Rotman Magazine. And I said, there's a bit of a problem here. And the problem is, do you know how many employees Rotman Magazine has? The entire magazine for publishing, editing, distribution, sales, marketing, all of that. He said, I don't know, a dozen or something. I said, one.
Well,
one. Karen Christensen. You know the name of the editor there? That's it. And in fact, the entire budget of the magazine would be probably about the salary of an HBR editor. And he was like mad at me because he thought I was lying. And I said, listen, I'm being honest. And if you want to check, phone up Karen, I'll give you her number. She'll talk to you. She knows of you. She knows of your work. She'll have a nice conversation with you, and you can quiz her about how many people work at Rotman Magazine. And the answer is one. But what could Karen do? Spend all their time sourcing stories, working with authors, putting stuff out. So we went from $13 million was our revenue in my first year. I was there for 15 years, $130 million in my last year. So we went up 10x in revenue, but in terms of administrative staff, it was only about 2 to 1. Huh. We went up double. So
that's crazy.
That's administrative staff. We were 4x the professors, but which are sort of in that business, frontline customer service people, right? So we went up 4x, but still not 10x. And guess what? We were a lot more successful and could do a lot better stuff and had much higher quality because people were doing their job, not meeting with people. So that would be my advice to all entrepreneurs. And a couple of times people came to me and said, Roger, we just have to, I need more people. And I said, okay, I understand. But here's the deal. I hate hiring people because you're just going to spend time meeting with other people. Maybe you're working super hard. What if I paid you 20% more? Hmm. Would that make you feel like you're being justly compensated? Which would you prefer, another person or that? And they'd often say, so occasionally they say, Roger, it's not about that at all. Here's
it's
why we meet.
Okay.
And then it was like the Inquisition. I really would want to know what that person is going to do so that, because my thought was with the person in front of me, is this person that you get going to make your life miserable? Because you'll be taken away from what you want to do and managing them instead. And you're just going to be more miserable. And so I had to be convinced that what they were, what this person was going to do would provide true leverage and true capacity increase. Would it be two, if it was one person, would it be, your capacity would be 200? I said, I'm not stupid enough to ever think it'll be 200. But if it's 180 or 170 or even 160, okay. 40% is like management nonsense, and the other 60% is real capacity. But if I think it's going to be 20% or 30%, we ain't doing it because you will be sad. Hmm. So that's my advice.
I love it.
And so we weren't a tiny business, right? We were like a $130 million is not a tiny business anymore. But not a gigantic, we weren't a $50 billion business, but we were consequential. And actually, when I left, the time I left to go become Dean Monitor was about $180 million business. And that's the way I managed both of them is.
So Roger, I'm sorry, I have to jump in because I am sure I can already listen my listeners saying like, how is it possible and how does it like actually work? What I mean by that is, does it mean that the person that is in place has to be like a huge superstar? Is it just a question of training, of experience? Could you give me a little bit more insights? Because I'm sure a lot of people will want to follow your path, honestly, but probably feel a little lost.
Sure. well, here would be my view on the superstar thing. So when, you know, when I took over as dean of the Rotman School of Management, I was this outsider, a Canadian, but I've been working down in the U.S. for many years, and it was like, oh, they got a great Canadian to come back, and he's going to be transformative, and he's a business guy, and so they expected me to basically fire everyone, right? They just did. They said, the business guy, they fire people and whatever. You know, the stereotypes. And so if I had, and I brought in fabulous people, we could make it a superstar argument. Oh, you got to have superstars. Yeah. I didn't. Most of the people who I exited with, including Karen Christensen, Ken McGuffin, who I referred to the magazine, the vice dean academic, the chief administrative officer, who's sort of the CFO, that's what they call them in the academic world generally, and lots of others. I brought in some people, but I mainly took the people that I inherited and helped them be better and. Typically, it was. I mean, what I'd say is, and there may not be many Star Trek fans out there, but Spock, right? If you remember, do you remember Spock? So he would do the Vulcan mind melt, right? He'd put his hand on somebody's head, and then their brains would think together. I'd do the Vulcan mind melt. I'd say I need to get totally simpatico. I need to get totally simpatico with Mary Ellen Yeomans, our fantastic CAO, so that we understand that we need to utterly transform us financially, create a different way of managing financially, and here's what the output it needed to look like. And we were this Vulcan mind meld where we understood together what we needed to do, and then it was go do it. Go get them, because she had capabilities that I didn't have. I didn't know anything about university financial management, which is bizarre. I promise you, Pauline, it's like it doesn't use the rules of nature. So she knew. She'd been at it for 20-ish years, I think, by the time I came across her. And she'd actually worked at University of Toronto Central before coming out to a faculty, the dean of the faculty of management. And so she kind of knew the inner workings and everything. Hmm. But then once you've achieved the Vulcan mind meld, it's a thin veneer of time. I didn't want to have her spend endless time meeting with me to review with me what she was doing. I said, no, you're great.
Just do it.
Just do it. Whenever you're worried, whenever you're nervous, whenever you see a boy, this is a big change, or this may really piss off Central. I need some advice on how to approach them on this because this is a radical. She would come and we would talk. But the previous dean of, I had the great fortune of having the wonderful Catherine Davis, who had been the dean's secretary for the last like three or four deans. And I worked with her on the calendar of the previous dean to find out how much time he spent on financial things. And it was a day a week. It was 50 days a year. My goal, and I told Mary Ellen Yeomans, my goal was five.
Wow.
Five. And she first thought, Roger doesn't care about this. And no. I care deeply, but you're great. And you're going to be great, and you have to be great, because I need those 45 days back to do something, some other things that nobody else can do. And that's what you should be doing, Pauline. If you're the CEO of a manager, you need to be doing things, not that you can do a little bit better than somebody else. It's ones where you can do something they simply can't. And not because they won't someday, but they don't have your experience today. They don't have your background. They don't have your creative, whatever the special thing you bring to. And so I said, there are 45 days that I need back from this that you can provide me by doing this. But my door is always open. If there's any difficulty, those 5 days, we're going to spend them really well. Hmm. And for 14 and a half years, I spent 5 days a year on all things financial. The previous dean spent 50 days a year on faculty recruiting, as in the bizarre world of the university. When you're recruiting a professor, they come and give a long job talk, and then there's a seminar, and you spend a day with them, and you do 20 professors to potentially get one, and it's endless spending. But academics love doing it because they get to, you know, be critical and they get to evaluate and all that. They love it. So the previous dean did what most deans do. And deans are responsible. That's one of their key responsibilities, hiring faculty members, right? That's it. And they have the signing authority to hire all tenure stream kind of faculty members as the dean of the faculty. It actually has to be approved by the provost of the university as well. But that's one of their big responsibilities. And they're so, you know, proud of it. And they like hanging out with the other academics and listen to job talks and whatever. And I said, gee, I got this guy, Peter Pauly. He's a very tall German guy Germany and University of Pennsylvania, Great American University, came here. And I said, like, man, this guy, and he was probably, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years older than me too. This guy's got so much more experience than I do. Why would I spend 50 days a year doing something where I'm no better? Yeah. I'm probably worse than Peter. That having been said, in the academic world, the way it generally works is when you're evaluating a professor for hiring them to a tenure stream position, which is an important thing, highly paid, important thing. What matters is their resume. How many published articles do they have on their resume? And so literally, I promise you this, Pauline, for most academic institutions, if you've got one Professor A has got 12 publications, he hates students and is a jerk to deal with, and Professor B has got 10 publications, students die to get into his class, he or she is awesome, and as a colleague, they're just fabulous to work with. They're not whining and complaining all the time. You'll hire the 12 every day of the week over the 10, over that, every single day of the week. And I had this Vulcan mind meld with Peter. I said, Peter, you know what? I think that there is this knock-on effect of hiring all those jerks who have lots of publications. It creates a toxic atmosphere. Professors don't work well together. You're having all this fighting and whatever. If we have happy professors, right, they can't have 2 publications, but if it's marginally fewer at this point in their career, but they're great supporters of students, they will support their fellow people, they won't get into arguments and fights, we'll create a culture where instead of spending time fighting with one another, they'll spend time really loving each other and loving students, and they'll actually publish more because it's a good atmosphere. And so that's what I want you to look for. They've got to be really good and really promising, but let's make sure we get really good folks. Vulcan mind meld. We totally agree. I spent 5 days a year. I didn't. I probably spent two or three days a year rather than 50 on that. And under my leadership, right, there are rankings, like official outside rankings. The Financial Times ranks your faculty. We went from not
on the sheet
on the list to to number 3 after Harvard Business School, Wharton.
That's crazy.
Which are insanely rich private Ivy League university. Number 3. We were ahead of Stanford, Sloan, Chicago.
That's crazy.
Because we followed kind of a different approach. But with that 100 days, so I went to try and get 100 of the 250 days back to do other things. I was able to do all sorts of things that other deans just couldn't imagine how they would say, "Do you never sleep? What? How is it?" I said, "No,
I know sleep. That's what people sleeping. Must have thought."
Yes, I love sleeping. I love sleeping a lot. But I just didn't have 100 days that they all had. 100 days. Can you imagine if somebody just gave you a gift of 100 days, like everything in your business worked just as it works today, but you suddenly had 100 days on your hands? What could you do? I bet you could do enormously.
Well, I'm thinking right now, Roger, about a lot of meetings that I have planned tomorrow and for the rest of the week for my business. And I'm thinking, do I really need to be there? No.
Yeah. No. So here, my advice to you, I advise executive CEOs all the time. And it's go to your calendar because thanks to Outlook, your calendar out the next 6 months, at least it's you pretty much know what you're going to be doing, and aim to take 24 days in the year to start 24 days out, gone, and then replace them with things that there's a very large gap between what you can do and what the next best person can do. Okay. Because I swear to God, there are 24 days in your calendar for 2024 right now that somebody can do as well as you, or like 95% as good as you. And there are 24 days out there that would be valuable to your company that
I do it, basically.
Yeah, nobody can do. And that's not being arrogant. It's just. If you look honestly at it and ask, okay, who could do that? Nope. So do those and do 24 days. Like I did 100 right off the bat. I just did 100.
Wow.
Screw it. I'm doing 100. But I say do it in tranches. And I do this exercise with CEOs, and I've not yet had a CEO who can't find 24 days, because you just slide into it. It's sort of like, well, that's the CEO always does that, right?
And there's informal pressure, of the have to meetings, basically.
Yes,
you have
yes.
to be there.
And it's an issue of do you care? Hmm. Right?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Pauline must not care enough. And I had to overcome that with Mary Ellen, who's just so fantastic. Mary Ellen Yeomans. Goddess, she was so fantastic, but she was sensitive, and her first reaction was, "You don't care." And I said, "Mary Ellen, you don't know how much I care about this. We are going to, and the cool thing, like, not to be too happy making, but she became utterly
responsible,
famous. No, but famous in University of Toronto. She would go to CAO meetings. And talk what she's doing, and everybody, "No, you get to do that? Your dean doesn't, you set stuff to the provost yourself? You go to the meetings with the provost yourself? And your dean's not?" "Well, yes, I do." Like it was very empowering for her, and literally the system that she created, the president, I guess two presidents down the line from when we installed it, said, this works better than the rest of the university, because we were an outlier. We managed ourselves differently than the whole rest of University of Toronto, which, by the way, is one of the biggest universities in the world. So it's a gigantic university. So Little Rotman, 130 million, I think it's a $5 billion university. The other $4.9 billion operated a different way. President Naylor said, "That works better. We're going to do it." Who was the architect of that? Who did people think of as the architect of that? They thought of me as having spurred it, but was I the architect? Mary Ellen Yeomans, architect. So it's just a win-win. I got to do things to build the Rotman kind of reputation and brand around the world that only I could do, while she was transformational in the way the school was managed financially, that made her famous, I could pay her, like in the academic world for positions like that, in 15 years, she would have expected to maybe get 15% more in total. She was earning double, unheard of, kind of amounts of increase. But I'd just go to the university and say, sort of like, she's sort of transformed everything, and now you're using it like, we do kind of need her around, right? And so that's that would be, that would be the advice. It's just, it's and thin slicing. I didn't not do finance. I did a thin slice of finance. I did not do faculty recruiting, right? Because of the other 100 days I was spending writing out in the outside world, professors who were trying to recruit, they'd bring them to me to help close the deal. That's a thin slice, right? Okay. Where I could say, listen, this is how I'm thinking of our professors. Our professors, I want to make them all stars. I want to repurpose their content from the academic world, where you're talking to other academics, but lots of this stuff is really helpful to the outside world. It's just written in language that nobody understands, myself included. And so if you come here, you'll have Karen Christensen interviewing you to get your work out. We have this lifelong learning conference every year where we bring people in. You'll be able to do that. Like I could help sell them on the benefits of coming to this place uniquely over the other choices that they had. But that's a thin slice. That's not sitting day after day listening to long job talks and sitting in the committee meetings where we evaluated all their papers and whether, you can tell. I wouldn't have been happy either for what it's worth, but I would be sitting there saying, I'm not better. And I'm not doing stuff that nobody else
can do.
Nobody else can do. So that's
love it. Really, it's
practical advice.
It's such good advice. Thank you so much. And I really feel that I'm gonna, after our call, open up my Outlook.
I want to check in with you.
I would love it.
A month from now, and ask you, have you gotten 24 days out of 2024?
Well, being coached by you, Roger, honestly, is a huge privilege. So thank you, and I will do it. It's a deal. But one other thing that really all your stories bring up to my mind is that you really seem to have a very acute critical mind. And what I mean by that is, it's about this book again and your way to think, and everything you were saying is basically reframing and seeing things when they're sort of forced upon you because of habit, because it's the way to go, because, those have to meetings have to get going. And it seems you have a very unusual way of being able to put a critical filter basically on those shoulds. How is this something that comes naturally to, I mean, this is a sort of maybe very low key analysis, but it seems that there's not only, the fact that you wanted to organize yourself differently on all other regards, basically you have a very critical mind. But when I say critical, it's not in a bad way, of course. It's the Greek way.
I see what you mean. And it's an intriguing question, because it is true. If I go back through my life, I was never great at just accepting whatever I was told. So I was trained as a dismal scientist, right? An economist. That's what we're called. And I remember, so my background is, I come from a tiny town of 50 people in farming country in Southern Ontario. And I got it into my head that I wanted to go to Harvard for university, which not many people from my town, zero.
I'm sure.
Ever. And I went to regional high school and whatever. And so I went to the big city at this like super duper elite university, and who me, this kid. But I remember, and I didn't know what I was going to take, but I took Economics 10, which was the first year economics course. And it was most courses were one term courses. It would just be in the fall from September to December and then another course. This happened to be a full year course, but it was split into two sections, microeconomics in the fall and macroeconomics in the spring. You know, the economics of individual firms in the fall and the economics of economies and how they work in the spring. And I remember in the fall sort of saying, well, this is really interesting where the curves cross and, you know, all of this stuff. Here's how production happens and here's how, you know, da, da, da. I said, oh, man, this makes lots of sense. I love this. And then we get to January. We get to macro. And I remember just sitting there with these, like, there were Nobel Prize winning economists teaching, because it was one of these survey courses where they trotted out all the great John Kenneth Galbraith and all these great geniuses. And I do remember sitting in class and saying, nope, do not buy this. I just don't. You're not making sense. You're extrapolating wildly. You're taking what happens in a firm in a market and saying, this is how the whole economy works. This is faux science. So, and that was me as a 18-year-old punk, listening to some of the world's most famous professors and just saying, no, it doesn't add up. And so I don't know. I don't know exactly what, kind of what did it. I probably will blame my mother, my late mother, she was a magnificent woman, just so magnificent. She would never answer any question. So if you said, Mom, I lost my toy truck, where is it? And she wouldn't say, well, here it is. She would say, I can hear, well, Roger. Well, Roger, where is the last time that you can actually remember it being in your hand? Okay. Now, can you think of all the places you've been since you last held it in your hand? Well, it was in the family room, and then I went downstairs, and da, da, da. And she said, okay, why don't you go find your truck? And sure enough, I would find my truck because but I had to think through everything. I was never told the answer. Never. Pauline, I mean never. And that never is a long time, 18 years of being a gift
she gave you.
Yeah. And so I tend to think it has something to do with that, which is you have to think it through yourself, Roger. I am not an answer provider, even though, of course, she probably knew the answer and had seen my truck somewhere, but she wasn't about to be an answer provider. So I never assumed that figures of authority, which your mother and father are sort of figures of authority, have the role of answer provider. In her case, she just decided, I am going to take on this role as a kind of a thought enhancer. I will give my son a way of thinking through stuff because she really wanted me to know. And in some sense, like she's a busy woman, five of us. I think she was like, if I give him this thinking process, he's not going to come back to me every day thinking.
I'll be free.
Yeah, she'll be free. She'll be
so
free.
So there, that's so where it comes from. Actually, your way of delegating.
It may well be. It's sort of her thing was teach him. Don't give him fish. Teach him to fish.
Yeah.
And so I think that I would give giving fair credit though to would be my father, the entrepreneur. He would often talk about competing differently than his competitors. And like, he was small, he faced really large competitors that are multi-billion dollar feed, animal feed manufacturer, multi-billion dollar company like Ralston Purina and Cargill, like these big companies that he was competing against. And so he would always emphasize, I've got to do it different. If I do it the same, they will crush me. And he always had many sort of bad things to say about how they treated customers. He felt that they lorded their gigantic size because these were small farmers. And it was like, you will take what we give you. And he said, that's not the way to treat your customers. So I probably got some from my mother, think from first principles. From my father, it is okay, if not necessary, if not meritorious, to think differently. And if you put those two together, you've asked me a good question. I've never put those two together before, but if you put those two together, it probably could fairly be seen as leading you to be sort of a critical thinker, which I think I am.
Roger, thank you so much for this honest and personal answer. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure a lot of people will resonate with it. If you still have a few minutes, I have a few last, let's say, a little personal questions that I feel will create also more rapport maybe with the audience. So the first one is, have you ever in your life lived a great failure that we could talk about? And mainly what interests me is the lessons this failure taught you.
Oh, yeah. No. My life is chock-a-block full of failures. I mean, I've been fired by numerous clients.
Which is something that people, I think, would not expect.
Famously fired three times by Procter & Gamble. I've actually written about it. I went to Procter & Gamble as the customer I've served for the longest. I actually started working for them in 1986 and continued while I was dean doing some work for them. But I'm only working for them after having been fired three times, each of which was sort of a crushing blow. I told the story because there's a big P&G alumni conference every 2 years where alumni are brought back, and it's only for internal alumni people, but they decided I was internal enough. We've been around them for close to 40 years that they would invite me. And I told the story being fired three times on stage because I had a really fun interviewer who dragged it out of me. And it was apparently a highlight of the conference. And so I wrote a medium article on it. But, you know, in each case, it was a crushing blow. But you sort of, in each case, I think I did the right thing and got fired for doing the right thing, and was subsequently rehired. The last of which was, I was fired by Dirk Jager, the then CEO of Procter & Gamble, who fired me by letter. I've never been fired by letter before, but it was a letter saying, you must never appear at Procter & Gamble again. I forbid it. I still have the letter. But then in June 2000, so 3 months later, June 2000, he was fired by the board in many respects for the things that I warned him he had to be careful to not do. Mm. And the guy who they hired, or they appointed internally, was A.G. Laffley. And A.G. phoned me up the night the board said so, and he said, I'm going to be announced tomorrow, so you're an insider, okay? And I know you're mad at us for firing you again. We need help. I need help. Will you come back? And so I think my lessons are you have to kind of do the right thing. You got to be honest to yourself. You have to learn about it. Maybe I could have done it in a better way, but you have to trust that life will evolve in ways that if you're doing the right thing, good things will happen. And in this case, one CEO hired us back. Another CEO, it had to wait till the next CEO, which was 3 years. In this case, I only had to wait 3 months, but there you go. Lots of, I mean, the key is, it's probably a little maudlin, but the key is you just have to pick yourself back up. But if somebody was, somebody looked at me and say, oh, well, you're sort of like, you know, you're a successful dean and management guru and writer and whatever, that must have been because you have this unalloyed, you know, career of successes. my response to that is bull, right? No. I think whatever measure of success I've had is it's had by sailing close to the wind sometimes. And sometimes you sail too close to the wind and bad things happen. But if you're doing it for the right reasons and you reflect on it, you don't just act as if I was perfect. I wasn't perfect in each of these cases, but I was more doing the right thing for my client than doing the right thing for me. And over time you get a reputation for, hey, Roger's like, my reputation now is, hey, Roger's a straight shooter. Every once in a while, he's going to say something that you may not love, but he's doing it for the client. That would be my reputation now over time. And that's, I'm not going to be sad about that reputation.
It's a good reputation to have. Another question, if you could change anything in your personal or professional life, what would you do differently in hindsight?
I stay at things too long. That's certainly one thing. I think, like I stayed 15 years as Dean of Rotman. I could have done what I did in 12. I got talked into staying in the academic world for another 6 years. I didn't need to. I think at Monitor Company, I probably stayed 3 or 4 years after I wasn't fulfilled and happy in doing it. And so my general advice to people would be, if you feel you're learning in a job, like, am I truly getting better at what I'm doing? If it starts to slow, chances are, from my experience, it's going to slow some more. It's not going to slow and then, ooh, it just ramps back up again. It's probably because that venue is not a awesome learning venue for you anymore. And I stay too long at things. Things should be hard and things should be exciting. And if they stop being hard and stop being exciting, then
move
it's
on.
Time to move on.
Yeah. Great advice. Tricky question, or I find it interesting, but you might find it tricky. What do you find beautiful? Could be, of course, in a metaphor or in a pure, like, aesthetic way.
Well, my wife,
of course,
a beautiful person, both inside and outside. I do find great beauty in satisfied customers, right? Customers who, like, I think it's beautiful when, let's say, a couple who's been, you know, kind of working hard and not seeing each other, another go out to a restaurant and come away from the experience saying, that was awesome. The food was great. The ambiance was great. The service was great. That's a beautiful thing where the people are uplifted and made happy by something. So I think customers who feel uplifted by whatever they've done I think of it as beautiful. I guess I also just think of products or services that generally change our life because somebody was extremely thoughtful about them. I mean, it's kind of cool that we all have laptops where a screen folds down over the keyboard. That was created by Bill Moggridge, who is David Kelly's partner in creating IDEO for grid systems. And that was a beautiful thing because he created a solution that made all of our lives better. And now how many laptops with screens that fold down are there out in the world? Billions of them. And that's beautiful. So design, sort of a solutions to me are beautiful.
Love it. On the contrary, what irritates you? What drives you mad? What do you dislike? What do you resent?
I probably have the highest resentment for bureaucrats, right? Who bureaucrats / technocrats who just say, this is about me. You will fit my procedure, my process. And if the answer, and if they're questioned, why their truthful answer, whether they say it or not, is because I say so. So that drives me nuts. And the other thing that's allied to it that drives me nuts is dehumanization, right? I just hate when individual human is classified into a group and then treated as the group. They said, oh, well, you're a female entrepreneur, so you must be concerned about these things. You know, that drives me nuts. No, it's Pauline. She's got a name. She's got a face. She's got a set of lived experiences. And this is why I, like, you know, I hate racists. I mean, it's just so, you know, hard, but sexists, you know, whatever.
Why any form of stereotype, really?
Yes, because they are putting people in bunches, and we were not born to be in bunches. We were born to have affiliations. Like, people are very social. Like, you cannot keep people from being social creatures, but the fact that you belong to a clan of some sort, you know, a club that you like being by, people don't say, well, everybody who's part of this club or this writing group or whatever is the same. No. So that drives me nuts. I hate being fit into a box. I hate seeing people be fit into boxes. I love people being exalted for the individual contributions to humanity that they can make, that nobody else could make exactly the same way.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It's very inspiring. Now I have two or three last questions. Sure. The next one is what I call my non-politically correct question.
Okay.
Is there something you believe that is not widely shared, basically? You really realize that you have a common belief. I mean, honestly, it's going to be easy for you because the book in itself and everything that you've been doing for the past probably 20 years, it goes in this regard. But if there was one, in a way, thing that you believe and you find that the world around you does not share this common belief.
Yeah. It would be, and there is a chapter in the book about this, but monetary incentive compensation does not produce better results. The world believes it. The world believes it does. Funnily enough, the behavioral economists are coming riding to my rescue on this. I mean, it is interesting that no study has ever been produced, no rigorous study has ever been produced that show a positive correlation between monetary incentive based compensation systems and entity performance. There isn't, but the world spends probably a billion person hours a year on designing, administering, you know, incentive monetary compensations. So I don't believe that people are wired that way. And people say, but kind of Roger, don't people want an incentive to do a better job? And I say, yes. And you know what the incentive is? A, you get to keep your job, and B, your job prospects here improve. That is the incentive you want, motivational. You want somebody in your company who's at the lower level to think if they do a good job, they'll get to be a manager of other people or a manager of one of your products or services or whatever. And if they keep doing that, someday when you step down, you'll appoint them to the top job. That's human motivation.
To feel progress, basically.
Yes, to feel progress, to feel needed, to feel wanted, and they'll make more money in those in those jobs, right? Because that's the money that should be associated with doing that job well. But paying somebody to do a job and then saying, oh, and if you do it really well, we'll give you extra, it's stupid. And it doesn't work. Other than that, great idea.
Love it. Two last ones. A subject on which you have changed your mind. Does anything come to mind?
Well, one would be the compensation question. I used to believe in that. Another would be shareholder value, all these systems to say, well, we should track shareholder value, etc. There's a chapter of the book on that too. I used to be a proponent of it. Now I realize it's kind of a deeply flawed thing. So yeah, I now believe that in general, private companies are going to be in the long-term ascendancy. Publicly traded companies are going to disappear over time because it's a worse form of corporate organization.
Okay.
Like, I think we're going to look back on the period sort of 1935 or 40-ish to 2030 and say that was the period where we thought the widely held publicly traded corporation was the best corporate form.
Yeah.
People in 2050 are going to say, what were we thinking? We were such morons. That's such a stupid idea.
So if people are interested, they'll have to read the book to know more about this idea.
Yes, go buy the
book. And last question. Is there a book or books that really had a strong impact on you that really maybe made you change your mind, made you the person that you are? I mean, had the greatest impact on you. I would love to know these books and to understand basically why they had such an impact.
Yeah. It's mainly kind of non-businessy books. So
yeah, perfect.
John Dewey, Art as Experience. Overcoming Organizational Defenses by Chris Argyris did change my life, and I ended up then working with him for a decade on stuff. anything by Aristotle, anything by Peter Drucker.
Yeah.
So there's some. Some management in there, but it's more, I think if you want to be a great business person, I think there's more to learn from the classics than from much of what's written about management.
Well, except probably this new book, A New Way to Think. I personally think it's a great read, and I thank you again, Roger, for taking the time and for going into, you know, details, personal stories. I mean, I had a great time. If people want to reach out, so of course they can read the book, and I really entice you, your audience, to do it. But is there another way basically to reach out, to follow you on LinkedIn maybe?
Sure. You can follow me on LinkedIn and X. But if they've got a question for me, they can just email me. My email is mainly my name. So it's my first name, Roger, at my full name, RogerLMartin.com. Do not do RogerMartin.com, or you will reach a very nice real estate developer in Houston
who is fed up of getting your emails.
Well, he's not fed up. He's so nice. He sends them dutifully to me, and I send him books. He's a real reader, and so I send him books, and we're now buddies. But I feel badly whenever Roger Martin of Houston has to send me an email. So don't forget my middle initial L for my father, Lloyd. And so they can do that or look for me on Twitter or LinkedIn. And if anybody is a person, right, the medium self-publishing platform, I write a weekly column in Medium in what I call the Playing to Win Practitioner Insights series. I just started my fourth year. So there are hundreds of posts, and you can find me on Medium.
Great content. I'm sure. Well, you know, I didn't know it, so I'm going to go and check it out right after our call.
Perfect.
Thank you, Roger, so much. If you come to France, to Paris, don't hesitate to ping me. I'll be delighted to meet you in person.
I love Paris. I love France.
Well, if you don't like bureaucrats, you know,
there are a few issues. I think the UK invented bureaucracy, but France was an early adopter.
Yeah, we're very diligent on putting it, you know, into place. So anyway, thank you so much for your time. I had a great time, and I hope you did too. And
I did too. This was a lovely chat. Thank you for having me.
Let's meet in Paris.
Alrighty. sounds like a plan.
Bye bye les amis, c'est la fin de cet épisode, mais avant de vous quitter, quelques détails en plus. D'abord, pour toutes les infos sur le podcast et cet épisode, ça se passe sur polinegno.com, vous aurez tout promis, juré. Aussi, si vous souhaitez me contacter pour me poser des questions ou me proposer de nouveaux invités, eh bien n'hésitez pas à le faire directement sur LinkedIn, Instagram ou YouTube, je vous attends. Enfin, encore mille merci de m'avoir écouté jusqu'ici, j'espère de tout cœur que ça vous a plu et je vous dis à très vite pour un nouvel épisode.